Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Today's show is sponsored by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with true automation by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori. Get your first 2 months for free. Today's guest, the newly minted CTO of Groupon, John Higginson. This conversation goes everywhere, but I think you're going to love it. One, learning the nuances of becoming a CTO, what that is versus just being a lead developer, engineer, manager, whatever. In particular, if that evolution happens within a company. So if you've been a different role throughout several promotions within one company and then becoming the CTO, what does that do to the personality dynamic in the company? John joked about the fact that he has a lot less lunches these days. I think that's there's a serious part of this, and it leads also to what kind of leader you are. Are you a lead by example? Are you transparent? Is there an authenticity to you? Are you confident, but you don't have a huge ego? I think the future of leadership in this country, hopefully, but in the business world for sure, is radical transparency and being a leader that's approachable. We actually talked about baseball, which both of us really like, and it was an interesting analogy because the reality is a lot of the managers that we remember from our heyday could not be managers today, or at least not successful, because of the way that they try to direct their players to be a mini version of themselves rather than lean into what those players do really well, which in a world of business is no different than on the field. It's teams, and teams have to operate well, and the leaders have to understand that. So great episode that you're going to have. If you like this episode, check out the Technori Podcast on Spotify, which hopefully you found this there. That would be ideal. But you would also enjoy the Raise CEO, Jay Klumneiser, who was on the show, and a very similar cat to this guy, all different positions, CEO, CTO. Either way, fantastic interview. This is my interview with John Higginson, CTO of Groupon. Well, first off, I think a congratulations is in order. This is the first time I've seen you here, and you're now the CTO of Groupon.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I've been there for five. This is week number five, so it's been really
cool. You look well rested.
I hide it well. It's a lot of coffee. It's been great. The company's been super welcoming. The team's really good, and it's been just a really good onboarding process.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think for the listeners, it's going to be exciting for me. I have a whole bunch of things that I want to go through with you, obviously, about you personally, about being a CTO, which is a conversation that has found its way into this show, I mean, on and off for a couple of years now, where like we have these new, I don't know if you're how familiar you are with the tech community. I think you're fairly well involved.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Kyle Nakasugi from ClearCover, he comes on and they had raised the first big round that they did. And it was like the growing pains of realizing what a CTO is, not just the nearest developer that you knew when you got started. There's like, it's a role and there's different responsibilities. And then obviously I think a lot of people are gonna be interested to learn what Groupon does today and like all of the different things it's involved in, because it really is not just in Chicago, but in the tech landscape, it's the OG, that's like one of the original tech companies.
It was really the first big tech company, the first big IPO that we'd had kind of post the dot-com era.
Yep.
I grew up here. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
Where are you from?
From South Holland originally.
Okay, so, I'm Glen Ellen, so I'm a suburban child who claims Chicago as well.
Opposite ends. And, I saw the tech companies here, and for a long time it was, the big companies like Motorola, and, you had some early startups that came here, and then you had this momentum after the dot-com boom, and then Groupon, got really big, and you had Google making them a massive offer, and then them moving past that and doing their own IPO. And I think it really made people sit up and listen to what was going on here, had been going on here in the tech community for a very long time.
My first introduction to tech was actually driving around the suburbs and seeing Lucent Technology. Mm-hmm. This is like going in the Wayback Machine. Obviously, that building is no longer owned by Lucent Tech. Nothing is owned by Lucent Technology anymore. But when I came downtown, it was Groupon. That was the company everyone would refer to. You'd always right now, I think, for good or for worse, like Grubhub is one that is very commonly like the people like, oh, sure. You know, Grubhub. I'm like, oh, yeah. Groupon was the original of that. And so I think the getting started here, first we're going to do caffeine. So we got to get this started with the right cue. I would love to know your journey first and foremost, because I do think, and you'll see a trend here in the show, but there, well, maybe this is, I'm always all over the place. There's a founder, there's a CEO and the CTO, and there's a whole bunch of other very important components to a successful business. Obviously I'm not leaving them out, but they are the three roles in my opinion that have, not just because of the title, they have so much to do with the way that the company will exist in the future, the vision, the roadmap, and obviously the technology that's going to be developed, that there are undue pressures on them that I think all of the other operators, a CFO has responsibilities that are gigantic, and there's a visionary component to that, but none of that matters if the tech isn't where it's going to be in the future and the vision of where the company is going to be and who they're going to be when they're grown up isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, every company is digital, and not to, you know, not to minimize the contributions of my friends and other roles.
Minimize away.
But I mean,
it's your podcast, John.
You know, I think, you know, a lot of what happens in other roles operationally or finance is fairly well defined.
Yeah.
And to a large degree, if you're a founder, certainly if it's a brand new company, and if you're in tech, you are still inventing a lot of those pieces. Every company today is a digital company in some way. It is enabled, or it is solely driven by the technology, and there's so much dependency on that. And you couple that with the fact that it is very difficult to find all the people that you need and all the skill sets you need in order to make that happen. It does put a lot of pressure on those roles. You know, founders, it is trying to figure out what that business is and what that niche is and what is going to make you distinguished in the marketplace. And on the technology side, it's how do you build, and, you know, in the example of Kyle and ClearCover, like, how do you scale, right?
Yeah.
It goes from you're the, you know, the engineer that has all the answers to how do you build a 1,000 person engineering organization in multiple cities.
Yeah.
And those are very different.
Very difficult to do if you don't know what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the middle of finishing up Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney's book.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a moment he talks about. He was just recently in the, I think the most recent Bill Simmons podcast was also in there talking about this. So if people are listening, you can first download and follow Technori podcast. That's the first thing you should do.
Mm-hmm.
Then go to Bill Simmons podcast and listen to his Bob Iger interview. Bob talks about this moment about 3 or 4 years ago, which kind of seems crazy when you think about how big Disney is and ABC and the whole nine yards, that it was only a few years ago that this happened. But he was like, I'm not a big whiteboard guy. And so I am. He's not. But he was like, I pulled out a whiteboard, and he said, the only other time in my life I did this was with Steve Jobs when we were doing the Pixar deal. And he was like, I broke it out, and I started listing all of the assets that we owned. And he was like, which one of these assets are completely controlled by technology investments?
Mm-hmm.
And when he went across the whole board, he was like, we're a tech company. And he's like, that's the first time that it dawned on me that media companies, the successful ones, are tech companies that are in the business of selling SaaS content, not SaaS product to use for whatever. And it was like, it kind of blew me away. There was like one, probably the most powerful media head in the world or country. I mean, he's got to be pretty close.
Yeah, certainly by now.
For him to look at that and go, we're a tech company. We just happen to sell subscriptions to content. Kind of blows my mind. It shows you like everybody is in this space.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's interesting about that point that he makes is, yes, that's great that he identified that, but he's a CEO. He should know everything, right? But it turns out if he's a tech company, the CTO, the person who's managing that, the teams that are managing that, have more to do with the trajectory of where Disney can go than he does. He can only have an idea.
They have more to do with the enablement of it.
Yeah.
And I think it, you know, one thing that I try to educate new technology leaders about is they have a very important conduit role, translation layer role, which is they have to understand the business, and they have to be able to have conversations on both sides of the technical divide.
Yeah.
You can't roll into a boardroom or into the CEO's office and talk about all the super geeky things that you learned at the last reInvent conference, because it won't matter to them. What matters to them is how that can make the company move faster or get in front of a different category of consumers or being able to market differently and then be able to then translate that back to the tech team and say, now let's go build it.
Yeah.
Now let's make that happen. And I think that's important. It's an enablement role, but it is one that does, I think, have to uniquely straddle both business acumen and technical acumen.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think kind of the point I was getting with some of this is that it was not that long ago, maybe I'll say like 5 years ago, that I started seeing a lot of the CMO roles come up, and people are hiring for a CMO because it was a big prominent job. It always has been, but it's different now. And I remember when Ryan Benici joined G2 after his career across Salesforce and ad tech and all the rest, he is not technical in the CTO role, but he's a digital native. And I was like, in that company, it makes perfect sense. In most companies going forward, the CMO is a technical role at that point. And I remember somebody saying like, oh, the CMO is like the CTO. And I was like, it's like the other way. It's kind of sort of, you know, and, and, but the thing is that your career spans a lot longer than the last 3 years. So you've had to make changes over your career. What is the background that led you to be in a position to do this? Cause if you don't, if you're not aware of where you're going in your career, it's nearly impossible for you to get to the seat.
It is. And I, it took me a little while in my career to really realize that this is what I wanted to do. And if you'd asked me a year into, you know, a year out of college, what I wanted to be and was that a CTO, I don't know how I would have answered. I don't think I would have answered yes. I think I would have answered, I don't know. I don't know what that is. I just always loved technology. I mean, going back to when I was a kid, I was a, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I had a Commodore 64. And that was my entree into technology, right? And so, I, you know, I fell in love really early on with this machine that you could make do all kinds of different things. It was, you know, different from, you know, if you were a carpenter or you worked in some other physical media, you could only do one set of things with that. And this computer, you know, could play music, it could do video games, it could, you could write novels with it. And I've always been intrigued by, you know, what you could adapt technology to do. And, but I really liked, I was definitely the kid, you know, back then, you know, who was happiest in his room with a computer and all the lights off, right? Never seen human contact for, for a long time. And it took me like getting out of college and working for Applied Systems, which is the first company I worked at, which was, you know, really a, you know, a startup and really small and really new when I joined it, and realizing that I was really driven by the creation process more broadly, the strategy process more broadly, not just the writing code, but like how you think about products and how you think about solving that problem, and seeing the, seeing customers light up when you can give them something that changes the way that they work, or, you know, a lot of consumer technology, like the way they live, like change the experiences. And I think that was a realization that made me think, I'm not an engineer, I'm a technologist, a strategist, and that led me to think about leadership. And along the way, the other learning in that was that this is more a people role than it is a technology role.
And, 100%.
You know, there's lots of things that I could think of day to day, think about or work with a team day to day about different technologies. And it's easy to, you know, to focus on that. But it all starts and ends with having the right people to do it, having the right team culture, having the right communication, the right coordination. And good technology people are a scarce resource in every city I've ever had teams in. And so figuring out how to get the right people and get them integrated in the team is hands down the most important thing I need to spend my time on.
How, so there's like two, I have two questions that come out of the same thing. And one of them is learning how you evolved within the company and then make your way into being the CTO and how that changes the dynamics on a human level with the people. The other part of this that's, I don't know if it's a question for the audience or just my own curiosity. When I think of CEO slash founder, I don't, because of my background with Technoria, I think of CEO and founder sort of synonymously, but is not obviously mostly the case at companies at Groupon's level. CEOs, founders to obviously a greater degree, tend to work with the team. They lead the team, they drive the company, they have the vision, blah, blah, blah. But then they tend to go off on their own down the path and they start kind of scouting out, like, what do you think is coming down the path? What is opportunities we can get in on? What are some ideas that are crazy that we could try? And I wonder, as a CTO, whether it's just you personally or this is typical of the role, whether you're touching keyboards now or not, are you running around out there looking and trying to catch up on, like, what is the most cutting edge, crazy technology things that can be something that you can use as an asset down the road, and how you get certain people to work on pet projects to test this out? And like, are you doing that kind of stuff? Like, as maybe not in this right off the bat, but like in general, is that how you view it? Or is CTO different than, say, a CEO who's going to be running around, you know, hopefully playing with stuff?
I think you have to look ahead, and I think you have to keep that love of technology.
Yeah.
So I don't write code anymore for any of the...
Could you, though? That's the question.
I could, but I don't for two main reasons. One is it would so frighten the engineering VPs that I work with that I just couldn't do that to them.
Yeah.
The last time I did this, I was at FTD, and the head of engineering there, I did something because we were shorthanded, and I could just see the terror in his eyes. He's like, what if it's terrible? How do I tell him?
He's flipping the screen around from horizontal to vertical, trying to figure out, what did you just do?
Yeah. So, but I think it's really important to keep your hands in it. And so there's a lot of ways that I do that. I'll, experiment with technology on my own, playing around with different things. For a long time, I was involved in fantasy baseball.
Yep.
And I would use that as a catalyst to write an application in whatever the language or technology of the day was, just to figure out that technology and use it to run my baseball team. The apps were usually much better than the team, but it was a way for me to stay involved. And I'll drop into, architecture and technical meetings at the company. But I also, I'm a consumer of technology, and I'm the one, this is another thing that frightens my team, is if there's a beta or a trial of something, I've signed up for it and it's probably on my machine. And, I'm playing, hey, my phone doesn't work today. Well, what'd you download, John? Yeah. That's usually the question I get. But I think it's important, and if it's today, the thing that is here, and kind of the next foray for consumers is voice applications,
yes.
Right? It went from the science fictiony thing to a novelty to there's a real install base, both principally for Google and for Amazon, and Apple still has Siri, but. Now you're seeing a real footprint there.
I hope the Apple people aren't listening to that. They still have Siri. Head down.
Well, great. They were first, but first doesn't always, get you to mass market.
Yeah.
But it's a real platform now, and people are doing not just shopping, but other activities. And you're starting to see this profusion of voice applications to do all kinds of things. And I think, I think about Groupon where we are, and we are a consumer driven business. We have merchants that we enable to connect to a broader audience. And then we have consumers that are shopping on that platform, and where they go and where they want to be, we have to go.
Yeah.
And so if they want to be in their kitchen and talk to Alexa and order something, then, we have to be there.
We omitted Cortana, by the way.
We did. Yeah.
And we'll leave it at that. I think, too. So it's totally fine.
Yeah.
I
don't have my Zune with me. So
well, not everyone travels prepared. There's two things I want to nerd out on with you based on this topic. And then one of them has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the interview, and it will just be fun for us, assuming you play along.
Okay.
And the other one is just this voice thing. Cause obviously we do podcasts. I've said this story a million times, so it's fine. Going to Howard Tolman and telling him in 2012, this idea of this Technori podcast and this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he literally was like, that's a stupid effing idea. And it was radio. And I remember getting the first sponsors in 13 or 14. And they were like, what is, and podcasts had been around obviously before this, mm-hmm. but people didn't think of it and they had no understanding. And I was like, they're like, of all things that you could choose to build your medium in, why audio, why podcasts? And I was like, you don't get it. Every phone, if you're an iPhone person, every phone, you're doing 90% of your consumption on the go. And
right.
we're all ADDDDDD.
Right.
So if I can consume something by listening to it in short snippets, I'm going to take that over everything long term. So I'm in on that. And everyone was like, well, that's weird. So we started doing stuff with Rivet News Radio and a few other companies locally. And it's been sort of a passion of mine on the audio side because I really do think... going back to Steve Jobs talking about using the Apple Pen, which they obviously launched after he said, your finger is your pen.
Right.
We are getting to a point where we're doing so many things at one time that using your hand to search something or to set down whatever your baby, whatever it is. I never used audio calling for my Alexa or anything ever until I had she's 8 months old today. Vivi, congratulations. You're 8 months. Until I had Vivian. Now I'm holding this baby. I got a bottle in my hand. I got my phone in my hand. I need to say something to Alexa. But what lies this huge problem that I think you guys are absolutely going to be trying to solve among many others is the way that individuals use, the user experience for a phone. We've been given this platform. We've been told this is how you're going to scroll. This is what you're going to do. It's changed over time based on our usage, but generally speaking, somebody said, I designed this for you. Trust me, it's intuitive. Audio is a recall reflex. We don't all have the same thing. Some people are visual in their brain. Some people have photographic memories. Some people are complete morons and don't know what the hell they're saying. We have to create an audio UX that works for everyone, or at least can be customized,
yeah, that's
right, or over time can get smarter to work for you, John, different than me and Sam and Rachel and everybody else. And that, to me, who solves that problem first could almost have a leg up, even if their product is inferior to the next one, because they're easier to access.
I think that's right. I think we're still trying to, you know, the UI community refers to these as affordances, right? As the, you know, forgive the pun, the design language,
yeah,
that we're going to use for voice applications. And, you know, I think as it's become more mainstream, we're all piggybacking on what Star Trek was, where,
yep,
you know, they would talk to the computer.
It's actually a really, and now we have the Space Force, right? So we're really
the Space Force. Yeah. Although it's been pointed out online that the camouflage doesn't quite work in space,
because
you don't need green and brown camouflage,
yeah,
in space.
I don't,
but
I feel like I haven't been in space. You'd have to talk to Elon Musk on that. I don't know what's to go.
I haven't either. It's on the bucket list. So one day.
There's a guy who says he can get you there for 200 grand. So you're probably good.
But that's low Earth orbit. I mean, I want to go.
I think he said you can go to Mars.
Elon did?
I think he said, okay, he thinks it, depending on the volume of travelers, it can cost you 200 grand. It'll take you 2 years to get there.
Right.
FYI.
Yeah, it's a long journey.
But you can go.
Right. It's a long journey with low survival rates, but you,
yeah, to, yeah, be proven, but probably, yeah. There will be a catastrophe. But no, to your point, though,
yeah,
it's still Star Trek.
Yeah, we still, you know, we're still coming off of what we thought in science fiction this would look like. And as we use it practically, we start to see more real-world examples that will influence the way that that's designed. I think that's exactly right. I think the ability, I have Alexa at home,
yep,
and I use it for a number of different things. I have a thermostat that's wired to,
yep,
it, and it's kind of funny. You know, some of this is both, it's the convenience way, overarching the time to do it. So I can easily get up from whatever chair I'm in and go to the thermostat and change the temperature. But I am far more apt to just sit where I am and yell out to one of the three Alexa devices that,
yeah,
are listening, you know, Alexa, tell Ecobee to set the temperature to X. And it's felt clumsy when I first did it.
Yeah.
It's gotten a little bit better. But I think there's an opportunity there where one example for voice application platform designers, if you're listening, is for it to understand context, right? Because it's not terribly good right now at understanding context. So if I say set the temperature, it should know that I mean I'm talking to the device,
yeah,
on the wall, not asking for the weather.
Yep.
But if you ask any of the, I don't know about Cortana, but if, yep, you ask any of the main players,
she's not listening.
You will get an answer about the weather. You will not get an answer about your thermostat.
And I would say, as the CTO of your household and a publicly traded company, it looks cool for you to talk to the mic. I feel like
it does. I feel like it's something that impresses, you know, people that come over. You know, I can just,
yeah,
talk to. It is a risk, though. I mean, there's a great XKCD cartoon where somebody goes into somebody's house and says, "Alexa, order 200 pounds of cream corn."
I should
confirm.
Do that.
And, you know, if you don't have safeties on,
just order pizzas when I go to my wife's friend's house. It's like, order Domino's. We're done.
I think it'd be great at Christmas. I could take my list to somebody's house and just say, "Alexa, you know, here's the stuff.
Send
I
me
need.
My list." the funny thing is, like, to add a little extra pad to this before we move on to the next thing. If you look at to your point about the impact of how exactly this will work over time, when the like TuneIn and several of these Sirius radio types sold advertising and sold platform on like just go to Alexa and ask to play XYZ on TuneIn,
mm-hmm,
they made a lot of assumptions that people would be like, well, of course I'll do that. I don't need a radio anymore. I'll do this. Not only did they not use the radio, which they didn't use before, but well, for a certain generation. But nobody did that because,
right,
you had to go on the app and activate the skill. And there was like a million things you had to do. And you're like, I'm not ever like, we almost went into actually building an Alexa app for Technori and say, play Technori on Alexa.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started playing with it at home because we had it through WGN and TuneIn. And I was like, this is so clunky. If I don't use it and I'm trying to use it,
right,
no one's going to use it.
Right.
And it's just, I mean, it really does show you like they lost a lot. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars pulled out advertising when that didn't happen. So, I mean, the amount of money that is in this space of the audio tech, I think, is just ginormous. Where I wanted to waste some time going down a nerd hole with you is on baseball. It would appear that you're a baseball fan.
Yes.
I haven't done fantasy baseball in a long time, but I was back in the OG days of Jason Kendall and the Pirates was my number one pick year after year after year, and Chipper Jones. Where do you still watch baseball? Are you a baseball guy?
I still watch baseball. I'm for a long time I was a suffering Cubs fan. I was a long suffering Cubs fan. I still have the afterglow of 2016, but now I feel like I can now go back to what are they doing? Why aren't they better?
I was a lifer Sox fan, so I mean I went through a different struggle, and then you win a title and everyone's like, yeah, whatever. And it's like, you don't have any titles like since like 1900. What do you like? And there was no respect. There still is no respect, but it's been a miserable experience for me just the same.
I think it's harder to be a Sox fan in Chicago just because the Cubs it's so much outsized publicity for the Cubs. And look, I've been to, was it Guaranteed Rate Field?
Yes.
It's a very nice ballpark.
It is.
I was secretly excited for the White Sox in both 90 when they had the good young team Blackjack McDowell. And
I was at the New York Rob Yankees doubleheader as a kid with my dad when he flipped off the crowd.
Oh,
I mean, I can go down the whole lineup. Lance Johnson, Tim Raines, Ron Karkovice, Joey Cora, Ozzie Guillen, Robin Ventura, Frank Thomas, left field, George Bell until Albert. I mean, it's like I go down that. I loved that team. And then again, obviously, when they won the title and they had Aaron Rowan and all these other guys. And then all of a sudden the White Sox became the Carl Everett team. Like they bought him and Roberto Alomar like four times, and it was like it was a half Cuban team, and then the rest was just like a bunch of guys who had been great 5 years ago.
Yeah, they try. The Sox have always been really good about bringing talent up, and I mean all the success that they've had have been teams that where they've had a lot of good young talent and they built around it. They strategic trades or free agents. And then they try to buy a team. It didn't work too well. But the other thing too with the Sox team, I have to say, Ozzie Guillen was probably the last manager I can think of out of the like Billy Martin, Earl Weaver,
100%
mold of crazy colorful managers. You just don't see a lot.
Which
of that
he wants
anymore.
Back in, but he's not getting that chance. And I suspect that that's the reason. I don't know that the younger players of today with the money and the ego and things, not that they didn't have a ton of money then, but there were still leaders in the clubhouse like Jim Thome who were going to make sure that you didn't, act out. I don't know if someone like that can work anymore.
I don't know either.
It's like Lou Piniella. He lost all of his sort of clout when he was not really before the Cubs because he was such a loudmouth and was like, all right, you have like a 2-year shelf life. And then,
He came out of that Yankees environment, Buck Showalter, the 70s where, you had all these antics, but, look at the Cubs controversy last year where people were on Madden. Players were going to the press anonymously saying that they didn't like that they didn't know the lineup the day before. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, like, who cares? Your point, like it becomes inverted where the players are like, no, we need
– The manager can't run the team. He has no authority at that point. And like that's the whole social media, which is a very separate show. We won't go down that rabbit hole. But I'm just curious because like baseball, I find I'm very into sports. I always have been. But I particularly find it funny, like bringing up Kyle again. He played football at Wisconsin, Whitewater. Mm-hmm. Certain founders and types of people have sort of passions for different kinds of sports for different reasons. And I'm just curious for you if baseball was a matter of numbers. It's a game of numbers and it's got a lot of trends and there's a statistical piece to this which would draw you to fantasy, and I would imagine a brain like you have would probably fall in love right about there.
It was two things for me as a kid. So I loved the stats part of it. Loved this will not burnish my reputation as a cool hip person, but as a kid, like at 12-13, like I would make lists of like I would keep track of like Cubs players,
obsessive,
and I would like project like who could be better or what might make the difference. But I also really like the strategy, like you mentioned the Pirates. Like the Pirates when I was a kid, like in the mid 80s, experimented with this thing that they were never willing to fully commit to it, but a starter for 3 innings, a middle reliever for 3 innings, and a closer for 3 innings.
So the future of baseball.
The future of baseball, yeah, but everybody on like 2 or 3 days rest.
Yep.
Because you could do that if you didn't pitch a lot. And I really like the idea of like, wow, this is a totally different way to think about
sabermetrics for the A's.
Yeah.
Like that just like, I honestly, as a kid playing Little League, I loved, I mean, I was, Frank Thomas was my guy. Like I, my dad yeah. bought anything that he was at, I got to go to. And that was like, that was Scott's birthday. When I figured out the math part of it, and I'm not a math person, but there are certain trends in my head, like memorizing stats is something that comes easily, but it's also something I geek out on. When I realized that I could go to the plate, and every day before the game, my dad was our coach for most of the time, he would hang this white chart in this little plastic thing, and you could watch your stats throughout the season and see where you're at. And he would, I don't know where he figured this out, but he would move you up and down the lineup based on kind of how you were doing. And his own version of dad sabermetrics. Somehow I always ended up towards the top. It was great. No, but but I would watch, like, I'd be like, all right, I'm 3 for 4 today. And I would immediately come back and run to the chart and like pull out my thing. And like, what am I at? I'm at 642 right now, which in Little League baseball is a thing.
Right.
I'm not that good. It was just, that's a thing. I became obsessed with it. And then that led me into looking at the back of cards. And I would memorize everyone's years in every sport, all of their stats, everything. And now, like, I don't do it now, but like, I feel like certain people's brains, they can learn a lot from that. Like, if I'd have been paying attention and could talk to my younger self, I would be like, you should have leaned into that skill and applied that to a career that would, I've ended up where I wanted to be, but it took a while. And I think if you recognize early on that I like stats, I like order, I like, you know, strategy, you would have identified yourself as a person who probably would be really good at this job.
I think you can. I think the hard part, at least for me as a kid, I think all kids are different. I think if you had said to me, this is what you should do based on your interests, I would have rebelled.
Yeah.
I would have picked something totally opposite. In fact, the whole reason I'm a Cubs fan, I'm convinced, it's kind of in a distant childhood memory, is because nobody else in my family was. Because I grew up on the South Side.
Yeah.
And one of my grandfathers was a Cardinals fan because he grew up in Champaign. And I think the Cubs were like my act of rebellion. So I think
God for your parents, because that's a pretty that's a pretty soft rebellion. I'm going for this team.
Yeah, there were some other things later on. Yeah, but sure.
We don't need to get into that.
Teenagers, yeah.
That stuff's reported publicly now, so we can't even talk about that. We'll leave it at the Cubs fan.
I'll save that for the book.
So now onto the personal side of this and back on task for those listening. Everyone just hit skip for like 6 minutes. The growing inside of an organization, you develop kinship among your peers, you develop a lot of different relationships and they rely on you for different reasons. And then as you get promoted up the ranks, and in a lot of cases, some people, you know, they leave the company, they come back, they get promoted, blah, blah, blah. When you end up as a CTO in a unit that you're, you know, it's one thing to come on as a CTO of a new company. Mm-hmm. When you make your way up, I feel like it creates a unique set of challenges as a leader. What have you noticed and how do you work your way through that? And what is for good and what is something that is challenging that you have to work through?
I learned a lot, you know, particularly in my first leadership roles, and I learned a lot of things the hard way, but I also had some really good teachers along the way. You know, one thing you find when you move from being an engineer to being a leader of an engineering team, is, first of all, you're going to look at people doing things that will not be the way you did them. And at first it will be infuriating and it will be surprising. And then it will be humbling because you'll realize that you're working with people who are better than you were at that particular thing. And so I think the first thing to go as a leader is that kind of hubris or ego that only, you know, that only you could do it this way, that you're going to create a bunch of mini yous rather than figure out a way to just help everybody be better. The second is that people look at you differently no matter how hard you try as a leader to be approachable, to be accessible. As soon as you have that title, you wear it like this, you know, like this cloak that you can't see but everybody else has. Yep. And people just treat you differently. I joked, I'm like, I used to have a lot more lunch invitations before I became a manager. And you know, because people just, like, they look at you differently. And they also expect more out of you. I do some side projects outside of technology. And one of the things I'm really passionate about is just like people development, talent development. And I've actually helped put together and have taught in some leadership development academies inside these companies. And one of the things I always tell newly minted managers is you have to make sure that you're modeling the behavior that you want to see.
Yep.
Because if you tell, like, for example, I just did this with my team at Groupon, and they all kind of laughed at me, but I said, look, I'm going to violate this rule myself, so prepare to, you know, to benefit from that. I, you know, with my staff meetings, I said, from, you know, the meetings are going to start at, say, 10 a.m., and if you're late, you have to buy snacks for everybody in the meeting. And I said, and they kind of laughed. I said, no, I'm serious. And I said, trust me, I will, you know, I will violate this rule myself and I will do it. But I do, you know, that rule is in place just to make sure we're efficient with everybody's time. Cause it's, we've got people, I have people in 8 different cities at Groupon, from Bangalore, India to Seattle. So being efficient with our time is really important. There's a camaraderie aspect of it. It's a kind of a, you know, breaking down the barriers aspect of it too. But also that, like, I do the same thing. Like, if I rolled into every meeting 10 minutes late, and because trust me, certainly in the early days, nobody's going to say anything to me.
Yeah, of course.
But they're going to all notice.
Yeah.
And they're going to think it's, you know, it's silly, and they won't take anything else seriously. But if I abide by the same rules, if I abide by the same, you know, if I don't get it right, you know, they get snacks, then, like, they'll see that that's the behavior they model. And take that to a much more important thing is diversity, right? I talk a lot, you know, in companies and certainly outside of it. I work with a number of different organizations in the city around diversity for women engineers and for people of color. And you have to, as a leader, you have to keep saying that that's important. You have to, and you have to demonstrate. You have to model the behavior. Like, when you're hiring for your own team, when you're talking about investment in different organizations or sponsorships or scholarships, you have to model that behavior too. And that's one of the key things you learn as an early leader. The other is not to undergo a personality transplant when you do it. I think a lot of people tend to think that leaders have to behave in a certain way, and maybe, you know, over their earlier career, they saw
what
somebody. What they saw, and it might be a negative example. You know,
it almost always is a negative example, actually, because you take it one way or the other.
Right.
Like, you take that as like, I'm never going to be that person, or boy, that must be how they got there. Assholes always win. Like, that's not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you see somebody in the big chair in the corner office and they're a sociopath, you're like, oh, well, maybe that's what you have to be to, you
know,
to get there. And but the problem is, I think people need to understand that is you become successful, your early successes are because of who you are at core, and how people respond to that. And everybody's leadership style is different, and every company's culture is different, and you need to be true to yourself, and you need to find an environment that is true to how you want to lead and how the culture that you want to create. And I think that's a trap that early stage managers often fall into is, well, I've got to transform into this thing that I saw, you know, in this, you know, high level role, even though it's not me, because people see through that too.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I think we just answered the question as to why the Ozzie Guillen style managers won't exist. Because, I mean, truthfully, it's, you're talking about the same age. I mean, teams are teams. Mm-hmm. Whether you're playing sports or you're building tech, it's a team dynamic. And the age of people that you're managing are very similar to the age that they're managing. And what you just identified, you almost verbally read off what would be a book written by Steve Kerr and Joe Madden.
Right.
Like, they would basically say, yes, and we're part of the group. We live in a place we want to all be a part of. And if one of us is not happy here, then all of us have to make a shift, because we're not going to let one person be left out. Obviously, assuming that that's not a bad actor, like, we're going to make something that we're proud of, that we are going to live and abide by the same rules, that I'm not going to come out on the floor or on the diamond or on the court and tell you how to be a player that I was.
Right.
I'm going to try to make you be I'm amazed that Steph Curry is a better 3-point shooter than I was when I was one of the greatest 3-point shooters in the world. And yet I would let you do your thing and embrace that. And I think one of the things you see with the managers that were divisive, and you see this with the leaders that are divisive, is that the type of people that are raised now, and you can rip on how they were raised or not. You can go into that whole thing about millennials, whatever. The reality is, it is what it is. And you have a business to run and you can either figure out how to work with them or go find another job. And I think that one of the things that is most interesting to me about the very successful people that come through here, and we've had some that have come through that are not very successful. And when I look back at it, I always look at two things, that it's confidence versus ego. One person has an invisible cloak that enables them to run through a wall, but it's invisible. You're just wondering how this person was able to just like bear through it, and they didn't show weakness. They just did it. They were very confident in themselves and their team. And it was sort of I use this quote a lot, but it was, you know, a manager is a title, a leader is the people.
Right.
And so you have this sort of dichotomy. And then there's the ego leader who is like, I'm the shit and we're going to do it this way. And you're like, but that's, you're like hurting us.
Right.
And you can almost see in a clear line the people who have the problem. There's, if you could go back, I don't even know how one would do this, but if you could go back and statistically put a mark on the people as they get their first or second promotion and see how the team succeeds after those promotions, as they make their way up the chain, did their ego shift? They become a new person in the middle of that. And then they start, you see it on LinkedIn for sure, because they start jumping from organization to organization. It's like, my guess, ego, not confident.
Right. Yeah, and I think you see a lot of that. You see people that maybe have short-term success because they are, you know, they're the euphemism is hard charging, right?
Yeah, sure.
But you're
always fearful when consultants come in and say, we're hard charging.
We're hard charging.
This is not good.
And what you find is maybe they can bully the organization into short-term success.
Yep.
But people don't follow, you know, I said this to, I was talking to somebody, we're just kind of talking about different somebody I worked with a long time, we were talking about different people we know, and I said there's a difference between this person who manages in a, you know, in a candid and transparent way where it's not always good news, it's not always what you want to hear, but it's never hidden, and you feel like they're in it with you, and they want it, they view it as everybody's success, not they're going to take credit for it. And this other person who is all ego, and I said, the problem is when it's war, nobody's going to follow that person.
Yep.
They're going to go.
They become a shield for a minute.
Right.
Yeah. And then everyone goes.
Yeah. They're going to catch all the arrows. And
yeah.
Then everybody
get the
else
hell out of that. And like, not to name drop, but another great example of that, Jason Vandenboom, who was just on the show from Active Campaign Announcer Race. I mean, we just posted a quote on Instagram today. It literally was almost exactly what you just said. Was about the authenticity and like us being like, this is a full transparency. I have a million weaknesses and I'm hiring the best people I can to fill it. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of things that I bring to the table that are unique. And I want to let you feast off of those things I have so that you times 1,000 can do more than I one can do. And if you have that, I tell, another great example in this also is David Cult from Reverb, who sold it to Etsy. He literally would have this full transparency thing in the office where he'd walk up and ask random people on the team like their numbers. And it wasn't a thing where like, I'm trying to show you up. That's your job, is to know the numbers. And if you know the numbers, then we're good. And if it's bad numbers, that's okay. I mean, it's not okay long-term, but it's okay. So like now, what do we do to shift that? And there's a radical transparency movement that is going through a lot of these businesses, which I hope continues and I hope it accelerates to catch up, because right now we are in the midst, both politically, socially, and also business-wise, in a world where a lot of the old guard has a lot of power and there's not transparency and it's causing a lot of problems.
It is. And I think, look, we all need to deal in reality, right? Nobody, you know, first of all, no problems get solved if you hide them away. You know, like the old joke of, you know, they don't age like fine wine.
Correct.
And the other,
rot like grapes.
And the other is nobody's that clever. Like nobody like, well, I'm not going to tell you this thing.
Well, that's the ego thing, right?
Right.
Cause you think that you are that clever.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you this thing cause only I can figure it out. And then you assume nobody else knows. And the reality is like, if there are problems in a team or in a broader organization, oftentimes the leaders are the last to know.
Yeah.
Like the rest of the team's going, I wonder when he's going to figure that one out.
We won't go down that list of companies because there's a whole bunch of them. The last thing I want to go into real quick is what excites you most about Groupon's future? What are the things that you are, I mean, you're the guy who's working and leading the teams that are going to be building the future of Groupon. What does that look like?
You know, Groupon's this really great story with local commerce, and it really in many ways invented this category, this idea that you could have merchants of all different, you know, experiences and different vertical markets and give them a way to reach this huge audience. And you know, Groupon is also this great Chicago story, right? Yep. It was, you know, came out of just a small number of people, and quickly grew into this, you know, multi-billion dollar company that is in, you know, countries in North America, in Europe, in APAC. And I think when I look at that, I'm like, here's a company that really created this category and has this great brand name, has this great presence in local commerce, particularly around experiences. Yeah. Like if you want to do something, if it's something you know you want to do, or you're just like, hey, I want to do something different this weekend, where do I go? You go to Groupon.
Yep.
Because we've got that broad range of things that you can look on our site or on our app. And we've just got, you know, we've got the footprint. So it's figuring out how we continue to build on that, how we continue to both provide great experiences of all kinds to our consumers, no matter where they live, and to continue to have this really great platform for merchants. And, you know, we power a ton of small businesses around the globe, around all the countries that we're in, and continue to make that as frictionless as possible, you know, to give them the opportunity to get onto our platform, get more of their products and their services onto our platforms, and just be the place to go. And some of that's going to lead us to, you know, where consumers want it, how consumers want to do things. We already have, you know, Groupon has we've had 200 million downloads of our mobile applications.
That's it?
Yeah, it's a small number.
Yeah.
We have the sixth most popular app ever on iOS. And
that's incredible.
You know, just building on that, that's what really excites me, is just taking that foundation and just building on it.
I'm excited to see where it comes from. I was, short story as we wrap up, right? When I signed up for Robinhood for the first time to buy my first stock, the gifted stock that they gave me for the referral was Groupon. So the first stock I ever got was,
cool,
was Groupon. So comes full circle. I appreciate you taking the time. I hope you enjoyed this. It was
Scott was great. Yeah, it was great to be with you.
Awesome.
Today.
I love to talk baseball stats. We got today was a good one. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Scott. Good to talk to you.
You too. If you've got any questions for me or for John, DM me on Instagram or Twitter at Technoia or at Katoon. To invest in startups on the Startup Showcase, which is live on WGN Radio on Saturdays from noon to 1, go to technoia.com or listen live on Saturdays from noon to 1. Boom, that's a wrap.